Welcome to the Pro-Life Action League series, Converted from Abortion Provider to Pro-Life Activist. In the following talk, former in vitro fertilization expert Anthony Caruso explains why he quit taking part in medical procedures that offend the sanctity of life and devoted his practice to God.
You know, I don't know if it's the best thing or the worst thing to be the last speaker of the day. This tends to be the time people clear out and have to go to the bathroom or whatever and take it from there. But thank you. I want to thank Ann and Joe and Eric for inviting me. And when I was invited, I really didn't know in the first place why. You know, why would you bring someone like me to a conference like this? And I was up talking to the Lake County Right for Life people this morning, and when I came here to listen to these last things, I thank God that I wasn't here for the morning, because I don't know that I could stand here after listening to all the wonderful testimony I've heard today. And I thought to myself, what can I tell you? I am not an abortionist. I didn't do abortions. As a matter of fact, my first residency was in New York, and one of the several reasons my wife and I left New York to come back to Springfield was because I knew I was going to be forced in my next rotation to do abortions and didn't want to do them. So that's kind of where that was. And I started thinking, as the last speaker was speaking, about all of the ordeal it takes to become a physician. And anyone who's gone through medicine knows that it's an ordeal, and 95% of my class said they wouldn't have done it again when we stood there and graduated. And there are casualties that come as part of becoming a doctor, and I will tell you, abortion is much different for a man than a woman. And two of the casualties of my training are in heaven right now. But that's not why I'm here today. I'm here to talk about something very different and very very much something that maybe you won't think about first of all. And that is, when does life begin? And someone stood up here and said that they were life began at fertilization. And how do we look at it from that perspective? I come from a world where, again, just like everybody else, I had I come from a good Catholic family. My parents were on the front page of the Boston Herald when they got married in a double ring ceremony that was officiated by Cardinal Cushing. I must have seen that picture 1,000 times between the time I was 5 and 15. But and I'm the oldest of four kids that all went to college, and for one side of my family, I was the first person to go to college and went all the way to medical school. So it's a very, very proud time for parts of my family. As a child, I was also privy to become a choir school member in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And really the only thing that's germane to the story there is, as part of our training, we used to sing at the 8 o'clock Mass every day. And when you go to daily Mass, it's like a story. So it was a way in which we could get an additional type of support for ourselves, or what, training for ourselves outside of our classrooms. And we were felt pretty good about our belief in the faith. Now, of course, when you're a 10-year-old, you don't think much about social issues. But there was no question we always believed that Jesus was present in the Eucharist. And while we didn't necessarily go to organized confession, we kind of felt that just showing up for Mass every week was enough. And went through that time. And when I went to high school, that's when things started to change. I learned a lot about the world of consequentialism, and about how things are all relative to one another, and how justice can be relevant in many different ways. And the same thing went through to college, where I was asked to create God rather than have God create man. And that slowly ebbed away my faith, to the point where when I tried to get into medical school the first time and didn't, I really didn't know what to do, and I asked my girlfriend at the time what the hardest school class was in medical school, and she said it was epidemiology. So I went off and became an environmental epidemiologist and thought, wow, this is going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. But then I finally got into medical school and went out to medical school and learned all the different vagaries of it. And during that time, the ethics we got was still more of that consequentialism, justice and beneficence, and this is good, and relatives, and one person can be balanced against another. when we chose to do a residency, I went to obstetrics and gynecology and told you about my first year, because that was the year out in New York where we decided to come back because of abortions and the fact that there was also a llama living next door to us, but that's a story for another day. But we came to Springfield, and during that first year, I rotated in a bunch of different subspecialties, and at the end of that year, I was asked to be considered going into any of the subspecialties of obstetrics and gynecology. Well, we didn't have reproductive endocrinology at my residency. I had to come up to Rush to do that. And as part of the whole thing, reproductive medicine is a lot of office-based stuff. So you see women, do a lot of ultrasounds, do a lot of consultations, do all that kind of stuff. And I happened to be fortunate enough to be in a position that the first-year fellow decided to have a nervous breakdown and leave. And so I had to step into his place. And at the end of that time, the head of the fellowship came to me and said, "You can be one of us if you want to." And I skipped back to Springfield thinking, "Oh, I was invited, I'm invited, I'm invited, I'm one of them, that's great." And so I went back up after I got into my fellowship and started doing a lot of the different things that we do. Now, back in that time, it was sort of the earliest days of IVF, and we were doing things that we don't do now. We basically would take early embryos and put them in the uterus or put them in the fallopian tubes. There was a lot of gift going around. And that the people were getting pregnant, but probably not as much as or better as they do now. And as I went into practice, we slowly but surely were beginning to get better treatments and better technologies. So most of those early techniques, the gift and those things, went by the by as we started to do more regular in vitro fertilization. As that was happening, we were beginning to leave these embryos in culture longer and longer. So when we left them in the culture for 1 day or 2 days, that's one thing. Maybe we go to 3 days or 4 days or 5 days. And it kind of moves along that way. And we focused on the babies, much like many people in the pro-life cause do when you bring up this subject. They say, "Well, wait a minute, this is a pro-life issue. I mean, in vitro fertilization is a pro-life issue. Aren't there children that come of that?" And that's very true. And we never really thought much beyond that. As a matter of fact, we used to have an annual picnic that we would invite all the children and their families to come out and have a hamburger and a hot dog. And I would jump out of the car at the beginning of the thing, say goodbye to my family, jump into the crowd, and come back 5 hours later and greet and meet everybody else. And the newspaper would come, they'd take pictures, great human interest story along that way. But pretty much into the first couple years, I had one situation. We had a young lady come to us who had a hysterectomy for cervical cancer and had to undergo, wanted to have a child, and her mother had volunteered to be the surrogate for her. So we did in vitro fertilization, placed the embryos into the uterus of the woman. She got pregnant with triplets. It was the first time I ever had to talk to someone about the potential of a selective reduction. And I was really very much against the selective reduction. She seemed to be very concerned. She was 50 years old and was concerned about those things, and told her that realistically there was a risk to the selective reduction process and that she really needs to consider her options. And ultimately, that's what she chose to do. And the way it works, at least around here, is there's only one place that it's done. They do them up at Northwestern. And so you send them up there, and it's done. But that's really not the other half of the story. It's what happened next that was a part of the story. She came back for her first visit afterwards, and the morning I went into the office, my receptionist came to me and said, "Dr. Caruso, hide." I said, "Why?" "Just hide." I'm like, okay, so I did for a while, and they came back and gave me the old clear. I said, what happened? Well, the husband of the surrogate showed up. He has a knife. He had a knife. He wanted to kill you. I said, why? Because he didn't think that you would ever get his wife pregnant. And because she's pregnant, he didn't want her pregnant. So he wants your life in exchange. So I had to walk around with extra protection for a while. But all's well that ends well. And frankly, in that particular case, it wound up in the newspaper and took from there. But that was the first thing. Then about 2 or 3 years later, I was called up by a reporter. And the reporter asked me what I felt about same-sex couples. Now, this was about 10 years ago. The same-sex marriage thing issue wasn't what it is today. It really wasn't talked about much. But we had been taking care of some lesbian couples who were in community close to us in Valparaiso, Indiana. And some of them we've been able to achieve pregnancy with. And I said simply, they're just like everybody else. And that was all I said. And it went into the Sunday Chicago Tribune as an article, and that held firm. Now, I'd always been involved in my parish life. My kids were in school, and I was on the school board, and I was on the pastoral council, and I was on the finance board, and was a major donor to their golf outings, and we sponsored things all the time, and it was good. And I got called up by the pastor of the church and asked to come down for a visit. And I went in, and he asked me, did you do something with the Chicago Tribune? I said, well, yeah. What? Why? I said, did you say that same-sex couples are good? I said, well, I don't think I said that. I think I said they're just like everybody else. And he said, yes. And then we got into a discussion about the pluses and minuses of the in vitro process and how it basically relates to this couple in the Catholic Church. And I listened carefully, and I thanked him for his proposal, didn't quite understand what his concern really was, and left, but not before I agreed with him that it would be okay, best for me if I dropped off all the programs and all the committees that I was on. The next year, we went to a different parish, and my kids went to the school there. My wife, who's a wonderful woman that I've been married to for over 20 years now, is a theology teacher. And she would teach theology as best as she could, understanding the beliefs that we had, which were a little bit more on the liberal side of the Catholic tone, a little bit more social justice and things like that. And she would teach scripture and use the books we have, but also believing and belonging and things like that. And really, we kind of worked together. But as part of that, she went to Rome with the summer crew. And I think it was St. Mary Major she went to, but she was so impressed with what she saw, she went to confession for the first time in 20 years. She thought it was okay because the sign said English, the priest was speaking German, and wasn't sure that he understood her, so that was just fine. So everything's okay there. But when she came back, we had some things that went wrong. Now, first was we went to the annual banquet, and one of her colleagues took the opportunity to take me on, and we had an argument that really went on for the better part of the entire event about the rightfulness or wrongfulness of in vitro fertilization. And I took the aspect of the children, and he took the aspect of donum vitae, and we are still friends, I still hold that argument went to a draw, okay? But I was further backed up because that year was Howard Jones, the founder of IVF, the American father of IVF, was celebrating his 90th birthday. And as a treat, he was gonna have a conference where he was gonna tell his story about his involvement with the development of Donum Vitae. And so he tells us a guest story about how he went out there to the place that did and met with the six cardinals and schmoozed them and did everything, and that all the cardinals voted to allow IVF into the Catholic Church, and then that mean, nasty Pope said no. And really, that's not the democratic thing to do. And I was like, okay, now I have another bow in my quiver, and we can go along with that. So we move forward, and about 6 months later, we learned suddenly that my mother-in-law had passed away in the middle of cardiac surgery. And a few months after that, my father-in-law died of a massive heart attack. And that sort of rocked our entire world, and we were looking for something very different. And what we found was a church in the city of Chicago that was a little bit more faithful to the teachings of the church. I went to there for the first time. It reminded me of my days in the choir school. It was familiar. It was good, and we started to go to church there. And as part of our intake into whatever, I met with one of the priests, and I said, "Hi, I'm Tony Caruso. I am a reproductive endocrinologist," because I like saying that because it's big, long words. You can spit out, say it 10 times fast. "And I do IVF." And he sat me down, and for the next 3 hours, he described to me everything that I said, everything that I did was wrong, why it was wrong, what was going on, how I should really kind of evaluate my life. And then Dignitas Personae was written. And my wife read it first. She did not want me to read it. She was worried that I might go crazy. She was worried I might ignore it, too. But it was in the National Catholic Register. We just happened to have a copy on the kitchen table, and I read it. And I had to read it two more times because I couldn't believe that the Catholic Church had actually done what it did in that document. They had made all of the assumptions that we would make in a regular presentation. They said that despite this, that it was wrong and why it was wrong. Discuss the status of the embryo. And almost overnight, my perspective changed. Now, it didn't hurt that we were doing IVF retrievals and transfers at a stage now beyond where I started 10, 15 years before. And the embryos that were at the stage that we used to transfer them, they got pregnancies 15 years before, we were now discarding, and that we were being much and much more selective about what we were freezing because it costs money to freeze embryos, and we just didn't want to have to get too many more tanks up there, so we would do that too. At this time, I was in academic practice, which is kind of a wild thing. When you're in private practice, you kind of do your thing, kind of work with things, believe what you want to believe, just do what you do. But when you go into academic medicine, all of a sudden things change, because then you get asked to review articles, you get asked to do things you never would get asked to do in the private world. And I actually wound up, because of my interest in insurance, on the national board of the HMO of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois. And we would act like kings. We would say, you can't have IVF, you can't have IVF, you must have IVF, you cannot do these treatments anymore. We would meet and we would take a look at different cases. And I was doing this throughout. But I really started to get very uncomfortable by while we were talking about the embryos and where the embryos were. And then I was seeing that embryos that we were freezing at good normal stages were coming out of the freezer, broken down, and not dividing anymore. That these embryos were perfectly fine. But the real problem started, and I thought, okay, well, now we have to really kind of do something, but I'm going to do something slowly. So I asked the web people to change my profile so that it basically said I would offer natural family planning as well as other things. And that's something that nobody really noticed. And then we had a same-sex couple that came in and made all kinds of strange demands. They would change things up, go things down, drove the entire nursing staff insane. And I thought, okay, this is the second time. I really have to start thinking about getting out. So I started to contact people at some of the different hospitals. At the same time, my wife wrote letters to the cardinal and to our bishop asking for help. And the cardinal gave me access to the liaison for healthcare for the archdiocese, and through him, I got to meet people within different Catholic health places. And we were going very slowly. We started doing a lot more pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, though. And two things were happening in that phase. One, we were seeing embryos come out either affected or non-affected or indeterminate. And we were transferring the unaffected embryos, we were throwing away the affected embryos, but the indeterminate ones we were also throwing away, and I didn't quite understand why we were throwing any of them away, first of all, but why were we throwing away for certain the indeterminate ones? And at the same time, I became a dear friend with an international specialist of reproductive loss who told me under no circumstances should we ever throw any of these embryos away, because there's a certain percentage of them that will self-correct. And they would just become normal again. So now I started to turn up the heat just a little bit more on trying to find out what was going on. And then the third thing that happened was we had a woman who was extremely stressed that she wasn't pregnant. And in infertility offices, you see the women. They come alone. You never really meet the husband until you need them for something. And she was very concerned because she had never been pregnant. She was 42 years old. She was concerned about becoming pregnant. She had sent all these embryos off to be checked out at another major center in the city for abnormalities. There was one embryo that had survived all that. It was not the greatest shape, but she was going to have it transferred and hope for the best. Well, when the embryologist from the outside laboratory came in with the tank, there was no embryo in the tank. They had lost the embryo. And I, who was not even the patient's real doctor, primary doctor, had to go in and try to tell this woman that there was no embryo. And she didn't really take to me very well. So I asked for the embryologist who delivered the embryo to come and talk to the woman as well, and he refused. So we made a big deal of it, and I got our director of the IVF lab to contact him, and he came over. And basically, I didn't hear the conversation, but I got all I needed from the body language, because you could see through the door. He sat down, put his feet up, put his hands between behind his head, and basically told her, "Que sera, sera. Nothing we can do, nothing you're going to worry about, not our fault, nobody's fault, you just can't get pregnant, too bad." And as she walked out of the office in inconsolable tears, I said to myself, I have to get out of this, I just have to do this. So we stepped up our talk and I made presentations about a new type of center that actually sounds a lot like Dr. Buchalski's Tepiak Center that basically would only do natural family planning and other like things, not do contraception, not do sterilizations, not refer for abortions, and offer all types of natural family planning and gynecologic services. And every center I would go to would tell me that it was a wise idea, but not financially viable. So I was turned away from pretty much everywhere. I was interviewed at Loyola to be their head of reproductive medicine, and they went in another direction. And I just thought God was going to have me do that. I mean, this is going to be easy. Just put me here and we'll be fine. And it didn't work that way. But I was still doing what I was doing. And frankly, I had the highest pregnancy rate of any physician at the lab I was at. And I would chalk it up to that I was praying as I was doing these procedures. And finally what happened was they pulled me into the office because the university had lost $100 million, and I was last hired, so I was going to be first fired. And they told me that they were going to have to let me go. And they were surprised that my response was, okay. I didn't cry, I didn't yell, I didn't scream, I didn't ask for things, otherwise, but I mean, I had to find a job. So I left there. Certainly firmly believing that God had shown me this way, and thought, okay, now is going to come the time that I get to move into something big. And so I got an interview at a sister hospital to the university, and got a bite. The person in charge there was listening. She was going to offer me salary. All I had to do was become the chairman of their OB department. And I interviewed, and I was not get offered the job because they said I didn't look like the people who lived in the neighborhood, which was fine. I didn't care. That was great, but I still needed a job. So I would call and get recruiters to call, and they would listen to me and thought I was a great catch because I had 15 years experience, until I told them that I wouldn't write contraception, do abortions, or do sterilization. And then they ran for the hills. Some of these Catholic hospitals I called, they would say to me, there's just nobody there, and then I would watch residents get jobs there. And so I called a friend of mine at another Catholic hospital in Chicago and said, what do you have for me? And they said that basically they had a position as a hospitalist and that frankly that they would be happy to bring me in. Now, I hadn't done a whole lot of obstetrics in 15 years. I'd only probably delivered a half dozen babies since I left my residency. So I didn't really think of myself to be the first person they'd choose. But because of the support of the chairman of the department there and the fact that the university couldn't wait to get rid of me, they gave me like these incredible recommendations, and I got full obstetrical and gynecological privileges at the hospital. And then I went off to go off into the sunset. Well, that's the first half of that side. And then the other side happens for about a year and a half, I don't do anything. I have four medical students that see me every 6 weeks, and I'm teaching them as well as I can, because I'm like their babysitter, because I'm there all the time. And I'm what I call an air traffic controller for obstetrical patients. I sit in front of a screen and watch baby tracings all day and respond if something's bad. But then, two things happen. First, I get a phone call from a local parish that tells me that there's an IVF clinic being built a block away from their hospital. And can I help them with this in terms of trying to stop it? So I said, I don't know what I can do, but sure. So I had a couple of meetings, and then we went before the city council. And the first day, we actually made some headway, so much so that they tabled the discussion. Then they had a second day, and what came were the doctor, his patients, and all the kids. And it was just such an overwhelming show of force that they had to let the clinic go forward, and it won by a 9-0 vote. The second thing that happened was the HHS mandate hit, and I was asked to speak at the first of the speak out rallies here, which was one of those amazing bucket list experiences you have, you know, standing up in front of a full thing, full plaza of people and talking through a bullhorn that nobody could hear you from. That was bucket list material right there. Then I started giving a series of talks called The Commodification of Life. And at the same time, thinking that one of these days I'm going to stand up there, give this talk, someone's going to walk up to me, write me a check, and we're going to open up what I call the St. Anne Center for Reproductive Health. Well, that hasn't happened, but what I do see when I come out here is the love and the support that the pro-life people have for my issue and where we are. I am a full pro-life person. I believe very strongly that abortion is wrong. I've been out to some of these abortion clinics. I am just simply amazed at what you guys do. And the church I go to has a youth group that really is pro-life. And you know them if you're in Chicago, because they're the ones that have the yellow balloons. Okay. And my kids are part of that. And I really thank God for that. But, you know, it's a harder road going about talking about contraception and IVF. Because when you talk about it, the first thing they say is, well, it's kids, right? And I said this morning, you know, what you need to tell an IVF mother is, first of all, bless her children. They're children of God. They're always children of God. And when I talk to people and they tell me about this thing, I think, well, what's wrong with the kids? I said, well, there's other things that could go wrong with the kids, but really, they are children of God, no question about it. But how is the mother going to explain to her children when they come of age how they came to be? I mean, are they going to say to her, when mommies and daddies are in love, they come together and they have a baby and it just comes? Are they going to keep the stork analogy going? Or are they going to say, well, mommies and daddies love each other, they go to a doctor who gives them medicine, and then when a day's right, they take them to a room, and I listened to the last presentation in horror, because I'm going to say the same thing, get put on a table, get general anesthesia, wind up having a speculum placed, get a needle placed through the vagina into the ovary, all these little cysts are poked and fluid drained. Then I go home because I don't know what's going on. My husband's sperm is mixed with those eggs and is placed in an incubator for 24 hours. I get a call the next day about how many of my little babies have fertilized. And then I come back a few days later and they put a couple back. And that's how you came. Will they say that? Oh, and by the way, you add to that, I froze five of your twins. And they're in suspended animation because we're done having kids forever. I mean, can you really say that? But you know, an interesting thing is that the United States is kind of unique in the fact that they don't have any kind of thing in their Constitution that says that life begins at conception. Life begins at fertilization. But did you know that the Organization of American States has in its Constitution, life begins at conception? And as a result of that, there are places that have difficulty. That's why abortion is outlawed in many countries in Central America, and why I was in Costa Rica a few weeks ago talking about the actual status of the embryo. Because down there, the fight is to legalize in vitro fertilization in Costa Rica. And this is how they talk about life, the people who are in favor of it. That once the egg is fertilized, it is not a real human. It doesn't become human for 14 days until it can actually go beyond the point where it can split into twins. And then maybe we can talk about it being life. That there's no unmoved mover. And that this one practitioner, he doesn't have a problem with freezing because he freezes all of his embryos exactly when they are fertilized. And I said to him, when he thaws his embryos, which that sounds really nice, but it's a big process, and he puts them in a dish, and then he puts them into the incubator, he doesn't act like Frankenstein with them. He doesn't like zap them with electricity or throw drugs at them or anything like that. He just thaws them and puts them in an incubator, and they start to divide on their own. And if you didn't believe that the zygote was alive and living and human, how could you deny that the dividing cell is not human and living and worthy of life? But you see, they go from the side of Dr. Crick, of Watson and Crick, the DNA from high school. You may not know this, but Crick believed that life didn't begin until the child was a couple days old, because you wanted to find out if the kid was worthwhile. And I remind people who forget they're in medical school, when I talk to medical students, that the neurological system doesn't mature until 21 years of age. So are we going to say that life really doesn't begin until 21 years of age? I mean, there has got to be an unmoved mover. And as we protect the life of the unborn, we have to protect life of its beginning. And I don't know where that begins, to be very honest with you, because In all honesty, I'm sort of the only guy like me. I'm the only person who's board certified in the specialty who walked away from the field and talks like this. And it's fabulous. It's interesting when I give my talks to people. I used to give the actual talks I gave when I was in the field. And it's amazing the impact that they have on groups of people who have had children, who don't have infertility problems. When you show them what happens in the IVF lab, they're horrified. They can't imagine what we do. And the whole idea that now we're beginning to eugenically choose babies based on sex or status of their genetics or all those kind of things. And it's amazing to be part of where you are and be part of what you do. And I want to fight just like you do for everything we do. And it's funny, I came to the Speak Out conference in January just after I started to let some of this news out on Facebook. And the first person who responded said, "Hey, you're the Abby Johnson of infertility." And I met Abby and I said, "Hey, I'm supposed to be you." And she looked at me like I was insane. And one of the things, just to echo Dr. Bruchowski, is it's not just a matter of us all being all talking together, but the groups of us that look at things from the status point of natural family planning as being a good thing for people who want to space or maintain or improve their chances of conception, all kind of sit together in independent franchises. Because we all kind of feel like we're alone in this world. We don't coordinate with everybody else. You know, when I was still at the university, one of the first persons who called me was a woman by the name of Ann Milnick. She was currently a third-year resident in family practice, and she was thinking about starting a practice in New York, which she did open, the John Paul II Center, and do that. But she didn't get the approval of the main center for NFP in this country, and so it's hard for us to really communicate. And honestly, we have groups of people at Marquette, groups of people in Omaha, groups of people down south, groups of people out east, and we all kind of run our own little shops here. And we'll never get the word out to as many people as we have to do to be able to change this part of the culture of contraception and the ready use of artificial reproduction. Unless we can get into contact with groups and network, just like you do within your pro-life abortion people. Because it's just as bad. We have over 1 million frozen embryos in this country alone. And the frozen embryo is the real circular argument, because it was the one thing that Dignitas Personae could not come to terms with. You have an embryo that was created by a process that's considered illicit by the Catholic Church that can only be resolved by doing a procedure that's considered illicit by the Catholic Church. So that's why you can't readily adopt a frozen embryo, right? Because you get pregnant that way by taking a frozen embryo and frying it and putting it into you. That's not right. And we cannot come to an ethical decision, whether it's, you know, consequential or whether it's real, to determine what actually to do with these embryos. So we'll eventually, I think, come to some sort of arrangement. But how are we going to do that when every single cycle, pretty much, of IVF has embryos that are frozen, and no embryo that I know of in the entire United States has ever been thrown away for failure of the couple to pay for their storage? Now, they don't do it for altruistic reasons. They do it because they're afraid that people are going to come in 10 years from now and say, I want my embryos. But the thing is here you go. Here are these bastions of life. And, you know, I know that people believe this because I got this morning. And the very first picture, this is something called Watch Me Grow, which I think is really great. It's a nice fetal development thing, baby development. The very first picture is a zygote. It's a newly fertilized embryo, what we call 2PN. It's got two little circles in the middle of it. Reproductive medicine does not consider this living. They consider this a fertilized science experiment. And until it actually creates a pregnancy, it's not alive. And that is the singular change that happened in my world that made it almost untenable to do what I do now. Did not, then. So, I mean, I don't want to take up any more of your time today. I know it's been a long day. And I ask simply for your prayers for me, your prayers for this wonderful audience, your prayer for all of the people out there who seek to become pregnant, who cannot be pregnant, that they would follow God's will. And I usually end by telling people that one of the big things I've done since I left the field was kind of give myself totally over to the will of God. And I liken the will of God to a roller coaster. And I get on the roller coaster every day, and I never know where it's going to lead me, and I never know where it's going to go. But I know at the end of the time, whatever will happen on God's time, not my time. But whatever time God chooses, it will be the right time. Thank you.
Well, fortunately, we do have a few minutes for questions, if there are any questions for Dr. Crusoe.
Is there a support group for women who have used IVF?
No. And actually, the biggest thing that I worry about is not the people who succeed. It's the people who fail. We really do nothing for them. And I don't know if Elizabeth Ministries can take over for them or if we can get a kind of a division of Project Rachel started or something like that, but they just kind of go off and they have an increased risk of post-traumatic stress disorder that just came out this year and depression and all kinds of things that go on there. It's terrible.
Right here.
I know it's one thing when a couple try to conceive using IVF, but I had heard that at his previous talk how they are paying like college students that, like you had talked about at Naperville, to super ovulate to provide eggs, and this makes very dangerous, I think, the women's health mm-hmm. and just all kinds of complications.
Yeah, I mean, it's the part, you know, there are so many levels and depths to this. You know, if you've never heard about this before, I'm sorry. I really, and I want to make one big apology today to Eric Scheidler. Because we introduced him to this, and it blew his mind. So, because as you get deeper into this, you begin to realize things like this, that there are women that get paid upwards to $50,000 to $100,000 to give over their eggs. And this is not a benign procedure. These are procedures where we're placing needles blindly inside a woman's pelvis. And they can wind up bleeding, we can wind up with scar tissue, they can wind up with infection, they can wind up infertile, or worse. And it's all these untold stories.
Well, I apology accepted, I guess. but you know, it has been a privilege to work on this project in Naperville, and I have to say that it feels as if the pro-life movement has really neglected these children, and neglected these couples. We haven't really stepped forward. Of course, we've had our hands pretty full, indeed, mm-hmm. over the last 40 years. But I welcome the opportunity to step forward and start to reach out to, you know, through activism, through education, to try to deal with this problem, because it really is sort of the flip side of abortion and of contraception in different ways.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Dr. Caruso?
Doctor, have you had any experience with the survivors? You know how you have a tragedy like the Titanic and the survivor syndrome? In our practice, we've seen two patients, 18 or 19 years of age, come to us. At the end of the annual exam, at the end of the visit, she'll say, Dr. B, I think my mother wants to kill me. And I kind of get taken back. This has happened twice now in 18 years. And I said, what do you mean by that? She says, well, I'm a sophomore at George Mason. I'm studying biology, and you know, life begins when it begins. And I found out that my mother had IVF, and I found out that when I asked her questions, she never really told me about it. She said she was super ovulated. She made 22 embryos. 18 of them never made it. And so she sits there, and both women said the same thing. She said, if they're my brothers and sisters, my mother kept reassuring me that she did it out of love. And I simply looked at her and said, but does that mean that I'm alive at the expense of the death of my brothers and sisters? So I was wondering, in your practice, have you ever had this survivor syndrome?
I've seen it once since I left the field. Because see, what happens is I sit at my desk, I get phone calls from people. I get phone calls from patients. I get phone calls from people who want me to come and speak. And one day I got a phone call from a woman like that who had realized she was an IVF. She may have been 20 years old. And really, we wound up on the phone for the better part of an hour with me counseling her about that. And my worry, that's why I talk about the what to say to an IVF mom, is because I think that's going to start coming up more and more and more. Remember, the oldest IVF baby is only 34 years old. This field is younger than Roe v. Wade. And we have people coming into this whole line that are going to be reaching these ages things we don't know. I mean, last year was the first study that came out showing that IVF increases ovarian cancer rates. Well, it took 15 years to make that happen. Many times we don't have that kind of time for the data to bring that in. So all the data you're seeing with abortion that sort of started coming out 30, 40 years afterwards, we're going to start seeing that same things coming out in IVF 20, 30 years. Because in the early days of IVF, they weren't doing lots of IVF. It's only in the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, last year, the United States did about 150,000 IVF cycles. And probably 10 years ago, they did about 100,000 IVF cycles. But the thing is, back before then, it was maybe 10,000 cycles, whatever. We just didn't get the same numbers to get the kind of changes you'll see over time. And that's the scary part of this whole thing.
Dr. Caruso, I'm an identical twin. And I was wondering if there's been a study about the impact of reduction of multiple births. And is there a sense of knowing that there were other siblings that aren't there?
That's a great question. And the answer is I don't think so. And the reason why I wouldn't think so is we don't talk about selective reduction the way you guys do talk about abortion. I mean, you would not believe, unless you really knew what they were doing, that we were talking about the same thing. I mean, it's all, we got to make it safer for the other babies. It's okay. It's just a one little process. The baby won't feel anything. It's all really done very quickly. There's a small chance you'll lose the whole pregnancy, but it'll be so much more healthy than that. Remember, a couple years ago in the New York Times, they were reducing triplets to singletons. So, I mean, that was a more routine thing.
Doctor, there is a thought that possibly because these babies were conceived as they were and put in petri dishes, that the children implanted may not maybe have many physical problems.
Well, for 15 years, I poo-pooed the studies that were coming out talking about the possible problems with the children of in vitro fertilization. But there's just way too much data that shows that these children have an increased risk of cardiac problems, of gastrointestinal problems, of maybe even the delay. They have more cleft lips and cleft palates. They have a 37% higher chance of having chromosomal abnormalities. And that's been shown in studies, several studies now. And these pregnancies are abnormal too. So there's no, and I've seen that in my job I'm in now. I see these IVF pregnancies come in, and they have more problems with preeclampsia, more problems with preterm labor. And the attitude is different. I had a woman 23 weeks in preterm labor with a cerclage who asked her obstetrician gynecologist to remove the cerclage. And the reason is because she felt she could just do it again. We'll just get rid of this one and just do it again. And that's an attitude that I think is prevalent in the IVF people, that this is something that can be manufactured at will.
Dr. Caruso, while you're on that topic, is there a tie-in or association in the literature now between assisted reproduction and autism?
There's one study that suggests it, but really what they're seeing is the father of one particular procedure in IVF called ICSI, where we inject the sperm into the eggs, has been going around with a registry almost since the time that he started the process. And he's finding kids who have autism, kids who have developmental delay, that have school delay. And in the United States, more than 50% of the IVF cycles here are done with that procedure. And the feeling is they can fertilize more eggs that way. But yes, and do have those studies really been done in the United States? No. And that's because we really do very little follow-up on these babies once they're born.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk. I really appreciated it. I had one question. I'm an occupational therapist, and as a student, I did several of my doctoral rotations at an international adoption clinic, so working with all children who'd been adopted from other countries, trying to catch them up on developmental skills and psychosocial skills, things they'd missed in orphanages all over the world. But as I became a little more familiar with some of the international adoption agencies, I learned that several of them also, there was at least one prominent one that also offered, you could look into international adoption, but then you could also look into, we would help you connect with an IVF clinic. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you had ever heard of that or if you were familiar with that sort of relationship.
If it's what I think you're mentioning, we actually have a term for it. It's called reproductive tourism. And what's happening, just so you know, eggs are expensive. Gestational surrogates are even more expensive. You know, someone to hold your baby, you know. But if you go to another country, you can get the same services, same people that come step up for services for less money, significant less money. So sometimes they bring them here to the United States. More often now, we ship the embryos over there, and they wind up getting pregnant and being cared for in their home countries. And sometimes that's not so good. I mean, there was a report about 2 months ago of a woman who was doing this in India who died. And many of the stories that would happen over there are unreported, because realistically, it's such a tight-knit group that unless you really had that going forward, you wouldn't know. And how we were doing it when I was still in the field is they were contracting with the egg donors over in like Czechoslovakia and bringing them to the United States. They would get all the stimulation over there and come to the United States for to get the eggs out, and then they would go back to their country. So they would just come here for that. And that was a kind of a logistical nightmare initially. But now there are actual companies that are put together that will take care of all the middlemen and all the contracting and everything like that. So it's becoming far more popular now. Sad. Well, while international adoption is getting harder to do.
Well, thank you all for your questions. I think we need to close up our day now. Dr. Caruso, thank you so much. And I hand it back over to Tony.
Thank you for listening to this talk from the Pro-Life Action League's conference, Converted, from Abortion Provider to Pro-Life Activist, held on September 22nd, 2012, in Chicago, Illinois. For more talks from this conference or more information on the work of the Pro-Life Action League, visit prolifeaction.org.